Then his warm look yielded to one of deep concern. He glanced up through his windshield at the house, then started the engine and drove up the street. Passing Karis, he honked his horn and waved. Karis waved back, and when Kinderman's car turned the corner at 36th Street, he stopped and stood motionless for a time, rubbing gently at his brow with a trembling hand. Could she really have done it? Could Reagan have murdered Burke Denning so horribly? With feverish eyes, Karis turned and looked up at Reagan's window, thinking, what in God's name is in that house? And how much longer before Kinderman demanded to see Reagan, had a chance to see the Dennings' personality, to hear it? How much longer before Reagan would be institutionalized or die? He had to build the exorcism case for the Chancery. He walked quickly across the street to the Chris McNeil house, rang the doorbell, and waited for Willie to let him in. "Oh, Mrs. taking little nap now," she said. Karis nodded. "Oh, good. That's good." He walked by her and then upstairs to Reagan's bedroom. He was seeking a knowledge he must clutch by the heart. He entered and saw Carl in a chair by the window, silent and present as a dense dark wood. He was sitting with folded arms and with his stare pinned steadily to Reagan. Karis walked up beside the bed and looked down. The whites of the eyes like milky fog, the murmurings, incantations from some other world. Karis slowly leaned over and began to unfasten one of Reagan's restraining straps.
"No, Father, no!"
Carl rushed to the bedside and vigorously yanked back the Jesuit's arm.
"Very bad, Father. No. Strong. It is strong."
In Carl's eyes there was a fear that Karis recognized as genuine. And now he knew that Reagan's extraordinary strength was a fact. She could have done it. She could have twisted Denning's neck around.
"Come on, Karis. Hurry. Find some evidence. Think."
And then a voice from beneath him, on the bed.
"Ich möchte Sie etwas fragen, Herr Engström."
With a stab of discovery and surging hope, Karis jerked around his head and looked down at the bed to see Reagan's demonic visage grinning at Carl.
"Tanz Ihre Tochter gern?"
it taunted, and then burst into mocking laughter. German. It had asked if Carl's club-footed daughter liked to dance. Excited, Karis turned to Carl and saw his cheeks were flushing crimson. Hands clenched into white-knuckled fists, he was glaring at Reagan with fury as the laughter continued.
"Carl, you better step outside," Karis cautioned him.
The Swiss shook his head.
"No, I stay."
"You will go, please, Carl," the Jesuit said firmly, his gaze holding Carl's implacably until, after a moment or two more of resistance, the houseman abruptly turned and hurried out of the room. When the door closed, the laughter abruptly ceased to be replaced by that thick and airless silence. Karis turned his gaze to the bed. The demon was watching him. It looked pleased.
"Ah, so you're back. I'm surprised. I would think the embarrassment over the holy water might have discouraged you from ever returning. But then I forget that a priest has no shame."
Karis took a few breaths as he forced himself to concentrate, to think clearly. He knew that the language test for possession required intelligent conversation as proof that whatever was said was not traceable to buried linguistic recollections.
"Easy. Slow down. Remember that girl?"
A Parisian teenage servant, allegedly possessed, while in delirium had quietly babbled the language that finally was recognized to be Syriac. Karras forced himself to think of the excitement it had caused, of how finally it was learned that the girl had at one time been employed in a boarding house, where one of the lodgers was a student of theology, who on the eve of examinations would pace in his room and walk up and down stairs while reciting his Syriac lessons aloud. And the girl had overheard them.
Take it easy. Don't get burned.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch? Asked Karras.
More games.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
The Jesuit repeated, his pulse still throbbing with that distant hope.
Natürlich, the demon answered, leering. Mirabile dictu, wouldn't you agree?
The Jesuit's heart leaped up. Not only German, but Latin, and in context.
Quod nomen mihi est?
He asked quickly. What is my name?
Karras.
And now the priest rushed on with excitement.
Ubi sum?
Where am I?
In cubiculo.
In a room.
Et ubi est cubiculum?
And where is the room?
In domo.
In a house.
Ubi est Burke Dennings?
Where is Burke Dennings?
Mortuus.
He is dead.
Quomodo mortuus est?
How did he die?
Inventus. Et capite reverso.
He was found with his head turned around.
Quis accidit eum? Who killed him? Regen. Quomodo ea accidit ilium?
Dic mihi exacte. How did she kill him? Tell me in detail.
Ah, well, that's sufficient excitement for now, said the demon with a grin.
Yes, sufficient altogether, I would think.
Though, of course, it will occur to you, I suppose. I mean, you. You being you. That while you were asking your question in Latin, you were mentally formulating answers in Latin.
Yes, very funny.
All unconscious, of course. Yes, whatever would we do without unconsciousness, Karras? You see what I'm driving at? I cannot speak Latin at all. I read your mind. I merely plucked the responses from your head.
Karras felt an instant dismay as his certainty crumbled. He felt tantalized and frustrated now by the nagging doubt that had been planted in his brain. The demon chuckled.
Yes. I knew that would occur to you, Karras, it croaked. That's why I'm so fond of you, dear morsel. Yes, that is why I cherish all reasonable men.
The demon's head had tilted back in a wild spate of laughter. The Jesuit's mind raced rapidly, desperately, formulating questions to which no single answer was correct, but rather many. But maybe I'd think of all of them, he realized. Then ask a question that you don't know the answer to, he reasoned. He could check the answer later to see if it was correct. He waited for the laughter to ebb, and then smoke. Quam profundus est imus oceanus indicus? What is the depth of the Indian Ocean at its deepest point?
The demon's eyes glittered. La plume de ma tante. Responde Latine.
Bonjour. Bonne nuit.
Quam.
Karras broke off as the eyes rolled upward into their sockets, and the gibberish entity appeared. Impatient, frustrated, Karras demanded,
let me speak to the demon again.
No answer. only the breathing from an alien shore. Qui es tu? He snapped hoarsely in a fraying voice. Who are you? Only silence. The breathing.
Let me speak to Burke Dennings.
A hiccup. Sputtery breathing. Another hiccup.
Let me speak to Burke Dennings.
The hiccuping, regular and wrenching, continued.
Karras lowered his head and shook it, then trudged to an overstuffed chair where he sat, leaned back and closed his eyes. Tense, tormented, and waiting.
Time passed. Karras drowsed, then jerked his head up. Stay awake! And then, with blinking heavy lids, he looked over at Reagan, not hiccuping now, her eyes closed. Was she asleep?
Karras stood up, walked over to the bed, reached down, and felt Reagan's pulse. Then, stooping over, he examined her lips. They were parched. He straightened up and waited a little time, and then at last he left the room and went down to the kitchen in search of Sharon. He found her at the table, eating soup and a sandwich.
Oh, can I fix you something to eat, Father Karras? She asked him. You must be hungry.
No, I'm not, Karras answered. Sitting down, he reached over and picked up a pencil and pad by Sharon's typewriter. She's been hiccuping, he told her.
Have you had any Compazine prescribed?
Oh, yeah, we've got some.
Karras was writing on the pad. Then tonight give her half of a 25-milligram suppository.
Okay. She's beginning to dehydrate, Karras continued, so I'm switching her to intravenous feedings. First thing in the morning, call a medical supply house and have them deliver these right away. He slid the pad across the table to Sharon. In the meantime, she's sleeping, so you could start her on a sustenance feeding right now. Sharon nodded.
Okay, I will.
Spooning soup, she turned the pad around and looked at the list.
Karras watched her. Then he frowned in concentration. Sharon.
Yeah?
You're her tutor.
Yeah, that's right.
Have you taught her any Latin?
Latin?
No, I don't know any Latin. Why?
Any German?
No, only French.
What level? La plume de matante?
Yeah, pretty much. But no German or Latin?
No.
But the Engstroms, now, don't they sometimes speak German?
Oh, well, sure.
Around Reagan?
Standing up, Sharon shrugged.
Well, sometimes, I suppose.
She started toward the kitchen sink with her plates as she added,
as a matter of fact, now that I think about it, I'm pretty sure. Have you ever studied Latin? Karras asked her.
Sharon giggled as she answered, me? Latin? No, I haven't.
But you'd recognize the general sound?
Yeah, I guess.
She rinsed the soup bowl and put it in the rack.
Has she ever spoken Latin in your presence?
Reagan?
Yes, since her illness.
Oh, no, never.
Any language at all?
I mean, other than English.
Sharon turned off the faucet, looking thoughtful.
Well, I might have imagined it, I guess, but...
But what?
Well, I think...
Sharon frowned.
Well, I could have sworn I heard her talking in Russian once.
Karras stared, his throat dry.
Do you... speak it? He asked.
Oh, well, so-so. I took 2 years of it in college, that's all.
Karras sagged. Then Reagan did pick the Latin from my brain.
Staring bleakly, he lowered his brow into his hand and into doubt. Telepathy more common in states of great tension. Speaking always in a language known to someone in the room,
thinks the same things I'm thinking.
Bonjour.
La plume de ma tante.
Bonne nuit.
With thoughts such as these, Karras sadly watched blood turning back into wine. What to do?
get some sleep, then come back and try again.
Try again. He stood up and looked blearily at Sharon. She was leaning with her back against the sink, her arms folded, as she pensively and curiously watched him.
I'm going over to the residence, he told her. As soon as Reagan's awake, I'd like a call.
Yes, Father, I'll call you.
And the Compazine, okay? You won't forget?
She shook her head.
No, I'll take care of it right away.
Karras nodded, and with his hands in hip pockets, he looked down, trying to think of what he might have forgotten to tell Sharon. Always something to be done. Always something overlooked when even everything was done. Father, what's going on? He heard the secretary asking him somberly. What is it? What's really going on with Rags?
Karras lifted up eyes that were haunted and seared.
I don't know, he said emptily. I really don't know.
He turned and walked out of the kitchen.
As he passed through the entry hall, Karras heard footsteps coming up rapidly behind him.
Father Karras.
Karras turned and saw Carl with his sweater.
Very sorry, said the houseman, as he handed it over. I was thinking to finish much before, but I forget, I am sorry.
He handed the sweater to Karras. The vomit stains were gone, and it had a sweet smell.
That was thoughtful of you, Carl, the priest said to him gently.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Father Karras.
Carl spoke with a tremor in his voice, his eyes full. Thank you for your helping Miss Reagan.
Then averting his head, self-conscious, Carl turned and walked swiftly away.
As Karras watched him, he remembered him in Kinderman's car.
Why? More mystery now, more confusion. Wearily, Karras turned around and opened the door.
It was night. Despairing, he stepped out of darkness into darkness. He crossed to the residence, groping towards sleep, but decided to stop by Dyer's room. He knocked on the door, heard "Advance and be proselytized" from within, and entering found Dyer typing on his IBM Selectric. Karras flopped down on the edge of Dyer's cot as the younger Jesuit continued to type.
Hey, Joe.
Yeah, I'm listening. What is it?
Do you happen to know of anyone who's done a formal exorcism?
Joe Louis Max Schmeling, June 22nd, 1938.
Joe gets serious.
Now you get serious. Exorcism? You kidding me?
Karras made no answer, and for moments he watched expressionlessly as Dyer continued to type, until at last he got up and walked to the door.
Yeah, Joe, he said. I was kidding.
Yeah.
I thought so.
See you around the campus. Find funnier jokes.
Karras walked down the hall, and as he entered his room, he looked down and saw a pink message slip on the floor. He picked it up. From Frank, a home number. Please call. Karras picked up the telephone and requested that a call be put through to the Institute Director's number, and as he waited, he looked down at his free hand, the right one. It was trembling with desperate hope.
Hello?
Piping voice, a young boy.
May I speak to your father, please?
Yep, just a minute.
Phone clattering, then quickly picked up. Still the boy.
Who is this?
Father Karras.
Father Karras?
Karras, Father Karras. Down went the phone again. Karras lifted the tremulous hand, lightly touching his fingertips to his brow.
Phone noise. Father Karras?
Yeah, oh, hello, Frank. I've been trying to reach you.
I'm sorry, I've been working on your tapes at the house.
Oh, are you finished?
Yes, I am.
By the way, this is pretty weird stuff.
Yes, I know, said Karras, as he strained to flatten the tension in his voice. So what's the story so far? What have you found?
Well, this type-token ratio first.
Yes, Frank?
Now, I didn't have enough of a sampling to be absolutely accurate, you understand. But I'd say it's pretty close, or, you know, or at least it's as close as you can get with these things.
Well, at any rate, the two different voices on the tapes, I would say, are probably separate personalities.
Probably? Well, I wouldn't want to swear to it in court. In fact, the variance is really pretty minimal.
Minimal, Karras repeated dully. Well, there goes the ball game, he thought.
And, Frank, what about the gibberish, he asked. Is it any kind of language?
Frank chuckled.
What's funny? Asked the Jesuit moodily.
Was this really some sneaky psychological testing, Father?
What do you mean?
Well, I guess you got your tapes mixed around or something. It's,
Frank, is it a language or not?
Oh, I'd say it was a language, all right.
Dumbfounded, Karras stiffened.
Are you kidding?
No, no, I'm not.
What's the language?
It's English.
For a moment, Karras stared blankly. And when he spoke, there was an edge to his voice.
Frank, we seem to have a very poor connection. Or would you like to let me in on the joke?
You got your tape recorder there?
It was sitting on Karras's desk.
Yes, I do.
Has it got a reverse play position?
Why? Has it got one?
Just a second. Irritable, Karras set down the phone and took the top off the tape recorder to check it.
Yes, it's got one, Frank. So what's this all about?
Put your tape on the machine and play it backward.
What?
You've got gremlins.
Frank chuckled good-naturedly.
Listen, play it, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Good night, Father.
Night, Frank.
Have fun.
Oh, yeah, right.
Karras hung up. He looked baffled. He hunted up the gibberish tape and placed it into the recorder. First he ran it forward and nodded his head.
No mistake, it was gibberish.
He let it run through to the end and then played it in reverse. He heard the voice speaking backward, and then Reagan's demon voice.
Marin, Marin, Marin. Let us be.
Let us. English. Senseless, but still English. How on earth could she do that? Karras marveled.
He listened to it all, rewound the tape and played it through again, and again, and then realized that the order of speech was inverted. He stopped the tape, rewound it, and with a pencil and a writing tablet at hand, he sat down at the desk and began to play the tape from the beginning, while transcribing the words, working laboriously and long with almost constant stops and starts of the tape recorder. When finally it was done, he made another transcription on a second sheet of paper, reversing the order of the words. Then he leaned back and read it.
Danger. Not yet. Something unintelligible. Will die. Little time.
Now the unintelligible.
Let her die.
No, no, it is sweet in the body. I feel there is unintelligible.
Better
unintelligible than the void.
I fear the priest. Give us time. Fear the priest. He is
unintelligible.
No, not this one. The
unintelligible.
The one who
unintelligible.
He is ill. Ah, the blood. Feel the blood. How it sings.
Karras asked on the tape, who are you? With the answer,
I am no one. I am no one.
Then Karras, Is that your name? And the answer,
I have no name. I am no one. Many, let us be.
Let us warm in the body. Do not, unintelligible.
From the body into void, into
unintelligible.
Leave us, let us be, Caris.
Marin,
Marin.
Again and again, Caris read his transcription over, haunted by its tone, by the feeling that more than one person was speaking, until finally repetition itself dulled the words into commonness, and he set down the transcription and rubbed at his face, at his eyes, at his thoughts. Not an unknown language, and writing backward with facility was hardly paranormal or even unusual, but speaking backward, adjusting and altering the phonetics so that playing them backward would make them intelligible. Wasn't such a performance beyond the reach of even a hyper-stimulated intellect? The accelerated unconscious referred to by Jung? No, something at the rim of memory. Then he remembered. He went to his shelves for a book, Jung's Psychology and Pathology of So-Called Occult Phenomena. Something similar here, he was thinking, as he rapidly searched through the pages of the book. What was it? He found it. An account of an experiment with automatic writing, in which the unconscious of the subject seemed able to answer his questions with anagrams. Anagrams. He propped the book open on the desk, leaned over and read an account of a portion of the experiment. Third day. What is man?
Tefi hasel esble lias.
Is that an anagram?
Yes.
How many words does it contain?
5.
What is the first word?
C.
What is the second word?
E.
C? Shall I interpret it myself?
Try to.
The subject found the solution, the life is less able. He was astonished at this intellectual pronouncement, which seemed to him to prove the existence of an intelligence independent of his own. He therefore went on to ask,
Who are you? Clelia.
Are you a woman?
Yes.
Have you lived on Earth? No. Will you come to life?
Yes.
When?
In 6 years.
Why are you conversing with me?
E if Clelia L.
The subject interpreted this answer as an anagram for I, Clelia, feel. The fourth day. Am I the one who answers the questions? Yes. Is Clelia there?
No.
Who is there then?
Nobody.
Does Clelia exist at all?
No.
Then who was I talking to yesterday?
With nobody.
Caris stopped reading and shook his head. There was nothing paranormal here, he thought, only proof of the limitless abilities of the mind. He reached for a cigarette, sat down, and lit it.
I am no one, many.
Where did it come from, Caris wondered, this eerie content of Reagan's speech? From the same place Clelia had come from? Emergent personality?
Marin, Marin.
Ah, the blood.
He is ill.
His eyes haunted. Caris glanced at his copy of Satan and moodily leafed to the opening inscription, Let not the dragon be my leader. Closing his eyes as he exhaled smoke, Caris lifted a fist to his mouth as he coughed,
and aware of his throat feeling raw and inflamed, he crushed out the cigarette in an ashtray. Exhausted, he slowly and awkwardly got up, flicked out the room light, shuttered his window blinds, kicked off his shoes, and collapsed face down on his narrow cot. Fevered fragments spun and tumbled through his mind. Reagan, Kinderman, Dennings. What to do? He must help. He had to help. But how? Try the bishop with what little he had? He didn't think so. He could never convincingly argue the case. He thought of undressing, of getting under the covers. Too tired. This burden. He wanted to be free. Let us be. As he began the slow drift into granite sleep, Karis's lips moved almost imperceptibly, forming the soundless words, "Let me be." And then suddenly he was lifting his head, awakened by adenoidal breathing and the soft sound of cellophane being crinkled, and opening his eyes, he saw a stranger in his room, a slightly overweight, middle-aged, freckle-faced priest with thin strands of red hair that were combed straight back on a balding head. Sitting in the overstuffed corner chair, he was watching Karis and tearing off the seal from the packet of Galois cigarettes. The priest smiled. "Well, hello." Karis swung his legs around and sat up. "Yeah, hello and goodbye," Karis growled. "Who are you, and what the fuck are you doing in my room?" "Oh, look, I'm sorry, but when I knocked and you didn't answer, I saw the door was unlocked, so I just thought I'd come in and wait, and then there you were." The priest gestured to a pair of crutches tilted and leaned against the wall near the chair. I couldn't wait for very long in the hall, you see. I can stand for so long, and then at some point I've just got to sit. I hope you'll forgive me. Listen, I'm Ed Lucas, by the way. Your father president suggested that I see you." Slightly frowning, Karis tilted his head to the side. "Is that Lucas?" "Yes, it's Lucas all the time," said the priest, his grin displaying long and nicotine-stained teeth. He'd extracted a cigarette from the packet and was slipping a hand into his pocket for a lighter. "Mind if I smoke?" No, go ahead. I'm a smoker." Yes, Lucas said as he glanced at a crush of cigarette butts in an ashtray on the end table next to his chair. The priest held out the cigarette packet to Karis.
Try a Galois?"
No, thanks." "Look, you said that Tom Birmingham sent you?"
"Good old Tom. Yeah, we were buds. We were in the same high school class at Regis, and after that we did our tertianship together at St. Andrews on Hudson. Yeah, Tom recommended that I see you, so I took a greyhound from New York. I'm from Fordham, by the way." Karis's mood abruptly lifted. He said, "Oh, New York. Is this about my request for reassignment?"
"Reassignment?
No, I don't know anything at all about that. It's a personal matter," said the priest.
Karis's shoulders slumped with his hopes.
"Well, okay then," he said in a tone more subdued.
He stood up and walked over to the straight-backed wooden chair behind his desk, turned it around, sat down, and began to measure Lucas with a clinically appraising eye. To Karis, from this closer vantage, the priest's black suit looked rumpled and baggy, even seedy. There was dandruff on the shoulders. The priest had pulled a cigarette out of its package, and now he lit it with the leaping tall flame of a Zippo lighter that he seemed to have produced unnoticed from a pocket, like a magician's sleight of hand, and then blew out a stream of moody, bluish-gray smoke, which he watched with what looked like deep satisfaction as he drawled,
"It's just nothing like a Galois for the nerves."
"Are you nervous, Ed?"
"A little.
Well, okay, then. Let's get to it, said Karras. You go ahead and lay it out for me, Ed. How can I help you?
Lucas studied Karras with a look of concern. You look exhausted, he said.
Yeah. Listen, perhaps it's best if we meet up tomorrow. What do you say? Then he quickly added, yeah, yes, yes, most definitely tomorrow. Could you hand those to me, please? He had reached out a hand to the crutches. No, 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 Karras told him. I'm fine, Ed, just fine. Leaning forward with his hands clasped together between his knees, Karras scanned the priest's face as he told him, procrastination is what we often call resistance. Lucas lifted an eyebrow, in his eyes a faint hint of what might have been bemusement.
Oh, is that so?
Yes, it's so.
Karras lowered his gaze to Lucas's legs.
Does that depress you? He asked.
What do you mean?
Oh, my legs.
Oh,
well, sometimes, I suppose. Congenital, Ed? No. No, it happened in a fall.
For a moment, Karras studied his visitor's face. That faint, secret smile. Had he seen it yet again?
Well, that's too bad, Karras murmured sympathetically. Oh, well, that's the world we've inherited, not so, reacted Lucas, the Galois cigarette still dangling from a corner of his mouth.
He took it from his lips between two fingers and lamented amid an exhale of smoke.
Ah, well. So, okay, Ed, let's get to it, okay? He didn't come here all the way from New York to play dodgeball with me, that's for sure. So let's open up now. Come on, tell me everything. Everything. Open up.
Lucas gently shook his head and looked aside.
Ah, well, it's such a long story, he began.
But then he had put a fist to his mouth, and a new spell of coughing racked him.
You want a drink? Karras asked. His eyes watering, the priest shook his head. No, 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 I'm fine, he said chokingly. Really? Really?
As the spasm seemed to pass. He looked down and brushed cigarette ash from the front of his jacket.
Filthy damn habit, he grumbled, as Karras noticed now what looked to be a soft-boiled egg stain on the black clergy shirt the priest wore beneath his jacket.
Oh, okay, Ed.
What's the problem? Karras asked.
Lucas lifted his gaze to him and said,
you?
Karras blinked.
He said, me?
Yes, Damien. You. Tom's terribly worried about you.
Karras stared at Lucas steadily now, with the beginning of realization. For in his eyes and in his voice, there was a deep compassion.
Ed, what do you do up at Fordham? Karras asked.
I counsel, said the priest.
You counsel? Yes, Damien. I'm a psychiatrist.
Karras stared. A psychiatrist, he echoed blankly.
Lucas looked aside.
Ah, well, where do I begin? He breathed out reluctantly. I'm not sure. It's so tricky. Very tricky. Well, let's see what we can do, he said softly, leaning over and tamping out his Galois in the ashtray. But then again, you're a pro, he said, looking up. And at times, it's best to put things on the table straight away. The priest had begun coughing into his fist again. Damn, I'm so sorry. Really?
The coughing ended. Lucas eyed Karras somberly.
Look, it's all this crazy business with you and the McNeils. Karras reacted with surprise.
The McNeils, he marveled. Listen, how could you possibly know about that? There's no way that Tom would ever let that out. No way. It would be harmful to the family.
There are sources.
Sources? What sources? Such as who? Such as what?
Does it matter, said the priest? Not at all. All that matters is your health and your emotional stability, both of which are clearly already in danger, and this thing with the McNeils will only stress it all the more. So the provincial is ordering you to break it off. Break it off for your own sake, Karras, as well as for the good of the order. The priest's bushy eyebrows had gathered inward, almost touching, and he'd lowered his head so that his stare and his visage seemed somehow threatening. Break it off, he warned, before it leads to some greater catastrophe, before things get even worse. Much worse. We don't want any more desecrations now, Damien. Do we? Karras stared at his visitor in bafflement, and then in shock. The desecrations? And what in the hell are you talking about? What does my mental health have to do with them? Lucas leaned back in his chair.
Oh, come on, he scoffed cynically. You join the Jesuits, leave your poor mother to die all alone in an abject poverty. And so who would someone hate for all of that unconsciously, if not the Catholic Church?
Here the priest leaned forward again, hunching over as he hissed.
Don't be obtuse. Stay away from the McNeils.
His eyes tight, his head angled in surmise, Karras rose and stared down at the priest, demanding huskily, Who in the hell are you, pal? Who are you? The soft ringing of the telephone on Karras's desk drew a swift, alarmed glance from Father Lucas.
Watch out for Sharon, he warned Karras sharply.
And then abruptly the phone was ringing loudly, so that Karras awakened and realized he'd been dreaming. Groggy, he got up from his cot, stumbled over to a light switch, flicked it on, and then moved to the desk and picked up the phone. It was Sharon. What time was it, he asked her.
A little after 3. Could he come to the house right away?
Ah, oh, God, Karras inwardly groaned. And yet,
yes, he said. Yes, he would come.
And once again he felt trapped, smothered, enmeshed. He lurched into his white-tiled bathroom, where he splashed cold water on his face, and, drying off, he suddenly remembered Father Lucas and the dream. What did it mean?
Perhaps nothing.
Yes, perhaps nothing. He would think about it later. When about to leave his room, at the door Karras stopped, turned around, and came back for a black woolen sweater, pulling it over his head, and as he tugged it down, he abruptly stopped, numbly staring at the end table by the corner chair. Taking a breath, and then a slow step forward, he reached down to the ashtray, picked up a cigarette butt, and then stood motionless for a time, as he held it up to his stunned surmise. It was a Galois. Racing thoughts, suppositions, a coldness, then an urgency.
Watch out for Sharon.
Karras placed the Galois butt back into the ashtray, hurried from his room and down the hall and then out onto Prospect Street, where the air was thin and still and damp. He passed the steps, crossed over to the opposite side diagonally, and found Sharon watching and waiting for him at the McNeil house's open front door, looking frightened and bewildered. One hand held a flashlight, while a hand at her neck held together the edges of a blanket that was draped around her shoulders. "I'm sorry, Father," she huskily whispered, as the Jesuit entered the house, "but I thought you ought to see this."
"See what?"
Sharon soundlessly closed the door.
"I'll have to show you. Let's be quiet now. I don't want to wake up Chris. She shouldn't see this."
She beckoned and Karras followed her, tiptoeing quietly up the stairs to Reagan's bedroom. Entering, the Jesuit felt chilled. The room was icy. Frowning, he turned a questioning look to Sharon, and she nodded her head and whispered,
"Yes, Father.
Yes.
The heat's on."
They turned and stared at Reagan, at the whites of her eyes glowing eerily in dim lamplight. She seemed to be in a coma, heavy breathing, motionless. The nasogastric tubing was in place, and the sustagen was slowly seeping into her body. Sharon moved quietly toward the bedside. Karis followed, still staggered by the cold. When they were standing by the bed, he saw beads of perspiration on Reagan's forehead, glanced down, and saw her wrists gripped firmly in the leather restraining straps. Sharon bent over the bed, gently pulling the top of Reagan's pink and white pajama top wide apart, and an overwhelming pity hit Karis at the sight of the wasted chest, the protruding ribs where one might count the remaining weeks or days of her life. He felt Sharon's haunted stare upon him.
"I don't know if it stopped," she whispered, "but watch. Just keep looking at her chest."
Sharon turned on the flashlight and shone it on Reagan's bare chest, and the Jesuit, puzzled, followed her gaze. Then silence, Reagan's slightly whistling breathing, watching the cold. Then the Jesuit's brows knitted tightly together as he saw something happening to the skin of Reagan's chest, a faint redness, but in sharp definition. He peered down closer.
"There, it's coming," Sharon whispered sharply.
Abruptly, the goose flesh on Karis's arms was not from the icy cold in the room, but from what he was seeing on Reagan's chest. From the bas-relief script rising up in clear letters of raised and blood-red skin. Two words. "Help me." A wide stare riveted to the words. Sharon's breath came frosty as she whispered, "That's her handwriting, Father." At 9 that morning, Karis went to the president of Georgetown University and asked for permission to seek an exorcism. He received it, and immediately afterward went to the bishop of the diocese, who listened with grave attention to all that Karis had to say.
"You're convinced that it's genuine?" the bishop asked finally.
"Well, I've made a prudent judgment that it meets the conditions set forth in the ritual," Karis answered evasively. He still did not dare to believe. Not his mind, but his heart had tugged him to this moment. Pity and the hope for a cure through suggestion.
You would want to do the exorcism yourself?"
Karis felt elation, saw the door swinging open to fields, to escape from the crushing weight of caring and that meeting each twilight with the ghost of his faith.
"And yet..." "Yes, Your Grace," he answered.
"How's your health?"
"My health is fine, Your Grace."
"Have you ever been involved with this sort of thing before?"
"No, Your Grace, I haven't."
Well, we'll see. Might be best to have a man with experience. Aren't too many these days, but perhaps someone back from the foreign missions. Let's see who's around. In the meantime, I'll call you as soon as we know." When Karis had left him, the bishop called the president of Georgetown University, and they talked about Karis for the second time that day.
"Well, he does know the background," said the president at a point in their conversation. "I doubt there's any danger in just having him assist. You know, in any case, there's got to be a psychiatrist present."
"What about the exorcists? Any ideas? I'm a blank."
"Well, now, Lancaster Merrin's around."
"Merrin? Had a notion he was over in Iraq. I think I read he was working on a dig around Nineveh."
Yes, down around Mosul.
"Yeah, that's right, Mike, but he finished, and he came back here, I think, 3 or 4 months ago. He's at Woodstock."
"Oh, teaching?"
"No, he's working on another book."
"God help us."
"Don't you think he's too old, though? How's his health?"
"Well, it must be all right. He wouldn't still be running around digging up tombs, don't you think?"
"Yeah, I suppose so. Besides, he's had experience, Mike."
"Oh, I didn't know that."
"Well,
at least that's the word."
"When was that? This experience, I mean?"
"Oh, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, I think, in Africa.
Supposedly, the exorcism lasted for months. Heard it damn near killed him. Well, in that case, I doubt he'd want to do another one. We do what we're told here, Mike. All the rebels are over there with you seculars. Thanks for reminding me. Come on, what do you think?
Listen, I'm going to leave it up to you and the provincial.
Early that quietly waiting evening, a young scholastic preparing for the priesthood wandered the grounds of Woodstock Seminary in Maryland. He was searching for a slender, gray-haired old Jesuit. He found him on a pathway, strolling through a grove. He handed him a telegram. His manner serene, the tall old priest thanked him, and then turned to renew his contemplation, to continue his walk through a nature that he loved. Now and then he would pause to hear the song of a robin, to watch a bright butterfly hover on a branch. He did not open and read the telegram. He knew what it said. He had read it in the dust of the temples of Nineveh. He was ready. He continued his farewells. Part 4. And let my cry come unto thee. Chapter 1. In the breathing dark of his quiet office, Kinderman brooded above his desk. He adjusted the desk lamp beam a fraction. Below him were records, transcripts, exhibits, police files, crime lab reports, scribbled notes. In a pensive mood, he had carefully fashioned them into a collage in the shape of a rose, as if to belie the ugly conclusion to which they had led him, that he could not accept. Engstrom was innocent. At the time of Denning's death, he had been visiting his daughter, supplying her with money for the purchase of drugs. He had lied about his whereabouts that night in order to protect her and to shield her mother, who believed Elvira to be dead and past all harm and degradation. It was not from Carl that Kinderman had learned this. On the night of their encounter in Elvira's hallway, the houseman had kept obdurately silent. It was only when Kinderman apprised the daughter of her father's involvement in the Dennings case that she volunteered the truth. There were witnesses to confirm it. Engstrom was innocent. Innocent and silent concerning events that involved the McNeils. Kinderman frowned at the collage. Something was wrong with the composition. He shifted a petal point, the corners of a deposition, a trifle lower and to the right. Roses, Elvira. He had warned her grimly that failure to check herself into a clinic within 2 weeks would result in his dogging her trail with warrants until he had the evidence to effect her arrest. Yet he did not believe she would go. There were times when he stared at the law unblinkingly, as he would the noonday sun, in the hope it would temporarily blind him while some quarry made its escape. Engstrom was innocent. What remained? Gently wheezing, the detective shifted his weight and, closing his eyes, he imagined he was soaking in a sudsy hot bath. Mental closeout sale, he bannered himself. Moving to new conclusions, everything must go. A pause, and then, positively, he added sternly. And with that, the detective opened his eyes and examined afresh the bewildering data. Item. The death of Director Burke Denning seemed somehow linked to the desecrations at Holy Trinity. Both involved witchcraft, and the unknown desecrator could easily be Denning's murderer. Item. An expert on witchcraft, a Jesuit priest, had been seen making visits to the home of the McNeils. Item. The typewritten sheet of paper containing the text of the blasphemous altar card discovered at Holy Trinity had been checked for latent fingerprints. Impressions had been found on both sides. Some of them had been made by Damien Karras. But still another set had found that, from their size, were adjudged to be those of a person with very small hands, quite possibly a child. Item. The typing on the altar card had been analyzed and compared with the typed impressions on the unfinished letter that Sharon Spencer had pulled from her typewriter, crumpled up, tossed at a waste paper basket, missing it, while Kinderman had been questioning Chris. He had picked it up and smuggled it out of the house. The typing on this letter and the typing on the altar card sheet had been done on the same machine. According to the report, however, the touch of the typist differed. The person who had typed the blasphemous text had a touch far heavier than Sharon Spencer's. Since the typing of the former, moreover, had not been hunt and peck, but skillfully accomplished, it suggested that the unknown typist of the altar card text was a person of extraordinary strength. Item. Burke Dennings, if his death was not an accident, had been killed by a person of extraordinary strength. Item. Engstrom was no longer a suspect. Item. A check of domestic airline reservations disclosed that Chris McNeil had taken her daughter to Dayton, Ohio. Kinderman had known that the daughter was ill and was being taken to a clinic, but the clinic in Dayton would have to be Barringer. Kinderman had checked, and the clinic confirmed that the daughter had been in for observation. Though the clinic refused to state the nature of the illness, it was obviously a serious mental disorder. Item. Serious mental disorders at times caused extraordinary strength. Kinderman sighed, closed his eyes, and shook his head. He was back to the same conclusion. Then he opened his eyes and stared at the center of the paper rose, a faded old copy of a national news magazine. On the cover were Chris and Reagan. He studied the daughter, the sweet, freckled face, and the ribbon ponytails, the missing front tooth and the grin. He looked out a window into darkness, where a drizzling rain had begun to fall. He went down to the garage, got into the unmarked black sedan, and then drove through rain-slick, shining streets to Georgetown, where he parked on the eastern side of Prospect Street, and for minutes sat silently staring up at Reagan's window. Should he knock at the door and demand to see her? Lowering his head, he rubbed at his brow. William F. Kinderman, you are sick, he thought. You are ill. Go home, take medicine, sleep, get better. He looked up at the window again and ruefully shook his head. To this place had his haunted logic led him. He shifted his gaze as a cab pulled up to the house. He started his engine and turned on the windshield wipers in time to see a tall old man stepping out of the cab. He paid the driver, then turned and stood motionless under a misty street lamp's glow, staring up at a window of the house like a melancholy traveler frozen in time. As the cab pulled away and rounded the corner of 36th Street, Kinderman quickly pulled out to follow. As he turned the corner, he blinked his headlights, signaling the cab to stop, while inside the McNeil house at that moment, Karras and Carl were pinning Reagan's emaciated arms, while Sharon injected her with Librium, bringing the total amount injected in the last 2 hours to 400 milligrams, a dosage Karras knew that was staggering. But after a lull of many hours,
The demonic personality had awakened in a fit of fury, so frenzied that Reagan's debilitated system could not for very long endure it. Karras was exhausted. After his visit to the Chancery office that morning, he returned to the house to tell Chris what had happened. And after setting up an intravenous feeding for Reagan, he'd gone back to his room in the Jesuit residence hall, where he fell face down and limp onto his bed, and instantly into a profound and deep sleep. But after barely 2 hours, the strident ringing of his telephone wrenched him awake. Sharon. Reagan was still unconscious, and her pulse had been gradually slipping lower. Karras had then rushed to the house with his medical bag and pinched Reagan's Achilles tendon, looking for reaction to pain. There was none. He pressed down hard on one of her fingernails. Again, there was no reaction. Karras grew alarmed, though he knew that in hysteria and in certain states of trance there was sometimes an insensitivity to pain. He now feared coma, a state from which Reagan might so very easily slip into death. He checked her blood pressure, 90 over 60. Then her pulse rate, 60. He had waited in the room then and checked her again every 15 minutes for an hour and a half before he was satisfied that both her blood pressure and pulse rate had stabilized, meaning Reagan was not in shock, but rather in a state of stupor. Sharon was instructed to continue to check Reagan's pulse every hour. Then Karras had returned to his room and to sleep. But now again, a ringing telephone awakened him. The exorcist, the Chancery office told him, would be Lancaster Merrin, with Karras to assist. The news had stunned him. Merrin, the philosopher paleontologist, the soaring, staggering intellect. His books had stirred ferment in the church, for they interpreted his faith in terms of matter that was still evolving and destined to be spirit, that at the end of time would join with Christ, the Omega Point. Karras had immediately telephoned Chris to give her the news, but found that she'd heard from the bishop directly that Merrin would arrive the next day. "I told the bishop he could stay at the house," Chris said. "It'll just be a day or so, won't it?" Before answering, Karras had paused, then said quietly, "I don't know." And then pausing again, he said, "You mustn't expect too much." "If it works, you mean," Chris had answered. Her tone had been subdued. I didn't mean to imply that it wouldn't," the priest reassured her. "I just meant that it might take time." "Oh? How long?" "Well, it varies." Karras knew that an exorcism could take weeks, even months, knew that frequently it failed altogether. He expected the latter, expected that the burden, barring cure through suggestion, would fall once again, and at the last, upon him. "It can take a few days or weeks," he'd then told her, and she'd answered him numbly. "How long has she got, Father Karras?" When he'd hung up the phone, Karras felt heavy, tormented. Stretched out on his bed, he thought of Merrin. Merrin! An excitement and a hope had seeped into him, although a sinking disquiet had followed. He himself had been the natural choice for exorcist, and yet the bishop had passed him over. Why? Because Merrin had done this before? As he'd closed his eyes,